Bakersfield, California, 2025. We open on a blank, empty sky. Louise Brooks-style Bob enters the frame. A slender, tall woman wearing skin-tight leopard print pants and a tube top enters frame, or maybe it's a bikini top, and she surveys a car turned over, and the film begins.
Incredible opening, I thought. Like, I was just in heaven. I had been watching that footage of Peter Stormare walking towards J. Todd down that hill in Fargo.
Yeah.
Like, the day before. And I had been watching, I watched Super Vixen last night on your recommendation. So suddenly I was, like, in this Russ Meyer Fargo, but then it was, like, also as kind of gnarly and deserty as the shootout scene in No Country. Like, as soon as they got there, I was like, oh, this is not as cartoonish as Driveway Dolls.
Yeah, it's not as wide-eyed.
No.
It's pretty... pretty darn cynical. It's gritty. People get hurt in this movie.
I mean, it was just a feast. I thought it was just like a banquet, you know, for my interests, just sitting there, just enjoying every moment. I took so many notes, and I'm so excited to talk about it.
And just for reference, last time we did Driveway Dolls, we did Rapid Response Road episode where Ray and I walked around, and in that spirit, Ray is actually walking around with the lav mic on.
I just left the theater. I like literally just watched the movie, stayed through the credits, and walked out, and now I'm walking back through the neighborhood Leawood in Kansas City. Very beautiful suburban day. And I just left the art movie theater is like a 5-minute walk from where I'm staying here. So
beautiful.
I walked over. Yeah, beautiful.
Walkable cities. Hashtag. I saw the film at the AMC 34th Street, which I think is a good theater to see a movie. It's not the Lincoln Square, but it's a little bit closer to my house. But this was actually my second time seeing it. So ordinarily on the show, I haven't read the script and Ray has. But in this case, I actually saw this movie for the first time about a week ago. So shout out to Focus Features for giving us a list of some screenings and giving us press access. I assure you that we will remain objective in our assessment of Honey Don't.
Well, this is like the situation where Focus let us see the movie for free, and then Trisha Cook gave us the lost pages of To the White Sea. So we're coming in objective.
We're gonna be talking a lot about objectivity and subjectivity and like analytic philosophy and like Kant and stuff on this episode. No, I mean, where do you want to start? Should we just like go through it, or do you want to give like just like immediate reactions or just like big memories you're gonna be carrying around?
Yeah, like the big things that really stand out in my head, having just seen it, that moment when the French lady is like, "They are French." Very secular, and like her eyes, like the glare on her sunglasses almost seems like her eyes are glowing for a second. I thought that was just like I will never forget that. That was just like indelible, strange moment, and just also so funny. Like the joke, "They are French," is just like such a punchline. And I love the, you know, the scene where her dad, the guy from the bus, who's initially just appears as kind of a bus station ghost, you know?
Yeah, and you don't know who he is.
Yeah, but by the time in the end where he's like, "You're gonna feel so bad when I'm dead," and she's like, "You're already dead. Has anyone told you?" It's like, this is really memorable, like powerful, kind of haunting Coen's moment.
Yeah, all of a sudden we're like in a scene from Fargo or something.
Yeah, yeah. And similarly, like the there was a performance by the mom and dad of the girl who is in the overturned car at the beginning.
Yeah.
Those people were killer. Like that put me in the zone where I was just like, man, it's just so nice to watch these like small supporting performances by these actors that you've never seen before. And they seem so real. It just like, that's that Coen thing of casting those like under 5 parts with just incredible people.
And such specific personalities. Like she says, "It's a woman." And then, and also too, like, you know, like their characters sort of unfold and you kind of realize how judgy they are over the course of the scene. "We don't take the bus. We're not Christmas trash."
Main two leads were incredible. I thought, you know, Qualley and Plaza both just like Aubrey Plaza, especially, I thought, like, just was kind of like, was, when you're watching a movie and you're like, oh, this actor is transforming into another person that I've never seen them be before. It was kind of amazing.
It's a real, it's a true performance. Like, it's a it's a character actor performance. And I look, I mean, Geraldine Vrinaswathan, I think she's Australian. So, like, obviously gives a very naturalistic performance that is transformed in a way. But,
oh, yeah.
But there is something about Plaza in this that's so flinty and so hard to predict. And maybe we'll get into it. We'll get, probably get into that a little bit more in, like, the back half.
You and I went and saw Megalopolis in the IMAX theater together, and I definitely felt like she was, like, the standout in that movie.
Auntie Wow.
And, yeah, in this performance, I was just like, I've never even seen her. It seemed like she was moving her face with, like, different wiring than I'd seen her move her face before. It was a complete physical transformation. I thought it was so cool.
Yeah, and it's hot. The way that they're instantly attracted to each other, and the way that Plaza gives her the breadcrumbs to sort of, you know, follow down the path when she says, I like those click clack and heels.
Also, I gotta say, like, up there in my top moments in the movie, like, that's just incredible. You know, that's an incredible line.
And the way that Quali reacts too.
Yeah.
I mean, we really haven't seen her, like, break composure at all, but there's, you know, you can tell they did that a few times and they were like, okay, that's the one. Cause she gets a little like, corny sort of.
I had the great experience of right before I came here, I finished watching Super Vixens, which I started the night before.
Nice.
Then I watched Driveway Dolls. Then I went right into the movie.
Hell yeah.
So I'm completely living in that world. Can you talk to me about Super Vixens? Like,
well,
what did I just see?
I mean, okay, so I hope I made clear that this was just sort of like a reference point, and I actually only watched the first half of Super Vixens. I just felt like the color and the camera angles and the use of close-ups felt very similar. Like, to me, like, in Super Vixens and in this movie, when there's a close-up on something, there's just something kind of fetishistic about it.
Yeah.
Like, when Cher puts the ring in her pocket, like, the close-up on the pocket and, like, the little sort of teaspoon of midsection that you see in that shot, and, like, the fact that the ring is important to her, just as one example. And there's tons of close-ups like that. That's the part that really just felt similar to how Russ Meyer shoots scenes.
Mm-hmm.
And that was the big surprise for me with Russ Meyer, is, like, I'd always heard of him as, like, an exploitation director, and I think in a lot of ways he's shoots kind of similar to the way Ethan and Trisha shoot, you know? There's a plan there. And then also just, like, the scene where Quali is destroying the guy's truck.
Yeah.
Like, to me, that seemed, like, directly out of the scene in Super Vixens where the guy's girlfriend is, like, taking an axe to his truck. And the way she knocks off the side mirror, that felt like a direct quote.
Yeah, I feel that.
I think when you watch those Russ Meyer movies, you also get a sense of the kind of generousness and unpreciousness that I think they're approaching the directing of these movies. They're so comfortable being genre pieces.
Well, I've never seen a film like Super Vixens before, and just for anyone who hasn't seen it, it's kind of like Candide.
Yeah.
About this guy with a jean jacket and jeans, and it kind of, like, looks like young Steven Spielberg directing Jaws kind of haircut. Like, everywhere he goes, he immediately gets involved in a sexual relationship with, like, there's always one bombshell woman, like, in every place he goes. And it's a different dynamic. And then he sleeps with them and then gets, like, chased basically to the next scene, right?
And it's telling him, yeah, and it is. It's like a, what is, picaresque? Is that the word?
Picaresque, right?
Yeah.
But just one of the most amazing things, I never seen a movie where every single man had a prosthetic penis and you saw every single man's prosthetic penis and their penis was, like, 2 feet long.
I feel like that would give a kid some unrealistic ideas if they saw that movie. You kind of realize that Russ Meyer isn't just thinking about big, buxom, curvaceous, domineering women. He's also objectifying men. He's thinking a lot about cars. Like, he has multiple interests.
Yeah. Yeah, it's true. I mean, I do feel the similarity of just, like, whatever object is in the center of the frame, it has a lot of power and is kind of, like, pushing the movie forward in this possessed way. You know, I feel like that about Honey Don't and about Super Vixens. You know, it's the similarity.
Can we take a tally on the Joel versus Ethan? Like, do you feel like you have an update on this based on what you've just seen? Because I think something that we've said before that I don't think is can be like supported by evidence is the idea that Joel's the one who's interested in gratuitous violence.
Oh, yeah. It's been destroyed.
It's, yeah, like, Ethan likes that stuff. Trisha likes that stuff.
My favorite was the scene where the Australian guy gets his face, like, shoved in the cutlery drawer, and they're slamming the cutlery drawer on his face, and you hear, you know, Skip putting all the sounds of the forks and the knives, like, jangling around. It's incredible. And then stabs him in the bottom of the face with the fork, and then the way he bleeds out of his chin is just so vivid.
It's a really great combination, I think, of practical effects and then a little bit of digital blood coming out would be my guess.
Yeah.
Like, or maybe the end, maybe the tines of the fork are added digitally also, because, like, how would you get it all the way in? Well, there's lots of ways. Okay, so let me ask you something. And I guess we are into spoiler-ish territory here. But just like a specific moment, when he's on the floor and he's like picking through the silverware, is he picking up like kernels of corn? What did you understand? I've seen the movie twice now and I'm still not sure. I'm still not sure what he was doing in there.
Those weren't teeth?
I don't think they were teeth. They looked like kidney beans, kind of.
Well, we're definitely, okay, so in a little bit, we're going to have the McDonough group. You want to just preview that? I feel like we need to ask them.
Yeah.
Like, what was that?
I'm
grateful right now that we have three guests coming in. And you're going to run it like the McLaughlin group. You have like a, because it's always provocative questions. I feel like that's what he does, is he announces the provocative question and then throws it to like Pat Buchanan, right?
Okay. Yeah. There's like a little, they say a little thing like, for over two decades, the sharpest minds.
Yeah.
The greatest thinkers. What do you think of Chris Evans?
I liked, right before he died, his little O that he did.
I really enjoyed the preaching scene. Just to give some context for what I watched Driveway Dolls, and then this morning I watched Lady Killers again. And it's interesting that there's a preacher scene in that movie as well, where the guy's talking about the Israelites getting smote. It's interesting in this one, Chris Evans talks about the Phoenicians getting their day of judgment. Because they're like macaroni.
The macaroni. When he got in the macaroni run, I think, like, everyone in the audience, like, starts paying attention, you know, in a closer way. Like, that's a great little run he goes on. And I feel like he really had control over that. Okay, so, Jordan, can we get into spoilers? And can you just give me, because you've seen it twice, your overview, like, what just happened in that movie? Because I'm a little, like, I know that she saved her niece.
That's a very good question, actually. So Honey O'Donoghue is a private investigator, and she's got a series of interlocking cases, much like any detective novel. The first scene she's investigating is a car that flipped over. It's a woman named Mina who apparently died in the car accident. She also has Billy Eichner come in, saying that he wants her to investigate his husband or boyfriend because he thinks he's cheating on him. Turns out that that guy was cheating on him, and he was receiving a drug deal shipment that he didn't want to pay for or didn't have the money to pay for from a guy named Hector, who is an associate of the preacher played by Chris Evans. Chris Evans is running drugs of some kind through his church, Four-Way Ministry, something like that. That guy killed Billy Eichner's boyfriend when he tried to pay for the drugs with a blowjob. Hector was shocked and appalled by this gesture, knocks his lights out, and then backs his car up and kills that guy. Chris Evans is sleeping with two church parishioners in BDSM harnesses. Is that what you call them, harnesses? And I guess he has a French connection going on where he's getting his drugs in from France. Mm-hmm. And this mysterious French woman that we met at the beginning is sort of trying to help him cover up dirty dealings of his church, but also would prefer to maybe replace him with someone else. The other thread of the story is that Honey O'Donoghue is, when she goes to the police station, to look into some of these cases. She goes to a woman who I guess handles evidence or addresses or something. For some reason, she has to go to part of the police station where Aubrey Plaza works, MG Falcone. And she, in getting the address of the woman who died in the car accident, gets hit on by Aubrey Plaza. They end up having a date and hooking up and having a second date. And we find out that Aubrey Plaza and Honey O'Donohue are both had abusive fathers. What else am I missing?
Well, her niece goes missing.
Honey O'Donohue's niece, Corinne, has an abusive boyfriend as well. He beats her up and we think maybe kidnapped her. And then she works at a hot dog store where she is, where this creepy old guy is not saying anything, but sort of waiting around for her to get off her shift. He comes up to her and says, "I love you," at the bus stop. And then she runs away and disappears for some time. Then we find out that that guy is Honey O'Donohue's estranged father. And Honey O'Donohue ends up going to a bunch of bus stations and looking for her niece all over the place. Realizes that the bus stop where basically she knows after her second date with MG, she knows what time MG left her house. And she knows that the bus stop near the hot dog place is close to, like, is around where MG would have gotten off the bus. So she decides to go to MG's house to see what's up. A major conflict ensues.
So Aubrey Plaza's character was still a part of the church, or she was, like, what was her relation to the church? Was she had been a part of the church, right?
It seemed to me like she was aware of who was going to the church and ended up attacking the woman who went, this woman Mina, who we see at the beginning of the movie in the car. She in Honey's confrontation with her, Aubrey Plaza ends up admitting to killing her father and some other women that she describes as victims. And she says that that church turns out victims who want to submit. And so she, I guess, admits to having stabbed this woman. I'm not exactly sure how that woman ended up getting into a car and flipping her car over. But that's the gist of it, the sort of big, the surprising reveal.
But yeah, okay, so I think like my first viewing, your second viewing, we're still in that zone. I think we're in that like Miller's Crossing zone where you're like, okay, the movie was pretty dense. Mm-hmm. I definitely understood the general thrust of it and the energy of it. But like, I'm going to have to watch it a couple more times to see where all the threads tie together.
Was there anything in what I said that was surprising or like made a connection you hadn't realized?
I guess it's just how much it's like the kind of the burn after reading structure. People are connected in more than two ways. And it's kind of almost like a miracle, the way that some people are thread back into the story because they have more than one attachment to the kind of pile of spaghetti.
Right. Yeah, especially Billy Eichner's characters.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's a big one.
Do you think the ending would have been better if Honey had said to Cher, "You are going to miss that plane"? Like the end of Before Sunset.
Baby, you are gonna miss that plane.
I know.
That opening montage set to the "We Gotta Get Out of This Place," that like when it kicks into the chorus has the shot of like 800 oil derricks all in the frame together. That was awesome. And I loved the location. They did a good job with that opening montage of being like, we are in this specific place that is gonna be a great genre setting for a hard-boiled movie like this.
What'd you think of the opening credits, speaking of the location?
You know, at first I was skeptical. I think like the Charlie Day one went over a little hard, but by the time it was getting to the crew people, I was like fully like, I'm into this.
It's interesting, right? Like it's sort of like the way it's digitally tracked onto the places.
It's not like Panic Room.
Yeah. Yeah. But it feels fun. It's cool to start the movie. Like we have the initial scene with Cher and we feel like we're watching a movie, and then it's cool for the opening credits to feel so almost like phone video out the window of a car. It really feels like shots that were just made by somebody driving around. No, but also like really interesting locales, really interesting like glimmers of life and sort of like the storefronts of different places. Like it felt much more lived in than Joel and Ethan's movies are so designed, right?
Yeah.
This felt like very free and unexpected.
Bakersfield is cool because it feels like LA, but I know nothing about it. It just seems like LA, but just gnarlier and more deserted, more spaces in between locations that are
more like Fargo, desolate, but very relatable. And the fact that it's, you know, when Billy Eichner says the thing about COVID, I was like, this is the rare Coen Brothers film that is taking place in the year that is released.
No, I mean, there's, you know, the characters use iPhones. There's MAGA stuff hanging out. What are the other Coen Brothers movies that take place in the present day? All I can think of is Burn After Reading. There must be more.
Blood Simple.
Blood Simple. Raising Arizona?
I don't know. There's like all the bumper stickers. There's political bumper stickers in the movie. Like, and he says in his narration, he's like, Reagan was president.
Yeah. It's like around the time. It's also just, yeah. But also like the Huggies diapers in that movie probably look like what the Huggies diapers look like.
Yeah.
Like that feels like it has contemporary references to its day. But somehow feels like a period piece of itself just because like of how stylized it is.
Yeah.
Miller's Crossing, obviously. I guess Lady Killers is Lady Killers present day? I feel like, yeah. I mean, it takes place in the early 2000s, I think.
I think so.
Yeah. And also Intolerable Cruelty, right? There's no time shift from when it was made.
No. Yeah. I think that's correct. Did you see the novel The Key Is Me by Dennis Gassner on the bookshelf?
I didn't. What was that?
It was in the dead girl's room.
What is The Key Is Me?
I don't know. It's one of her spooky like self-help spiritual books. Yeah.
When he's flipping through the book and you see it's all highlighted, like, isn't there something so sad about that?
I thought that was really subtle that it's like they missed the point of highlighting or like as the book is going on, it's just getting more and more relevant. So they're just like, well, I got to remember
it's just
all
like
of this.
Helping her read. I mean, it kind of reminded me of like the scene in Crumb where they're going through the guy's crazy drawings. And also, I guess, Mentaculous too.
Absolutely. You know? Yeah. It was a very subtle Mentaculous prop work of seeing like a degrading mental health through the use of like the highlighting marks. It's really funny.
It was a light touch Mentaculous for sure. I liked the cat in that scene too. I'm pretty sure they used a little split screen fancy stuff to get the cat in the reverse shot going into the other room, like at the exact moment they wanted it to.
Yeah. And it looked like the cat in a Long Goodbye too, right?
Looked like the cat in Long Goodbye. It looked like the cat in Lady Killers and kind of like the cat in Llewyn Davis. They like an orange cat. What are the other Long Goodbye? Because I didn't watch Long Goodbye. Do you remember any other reference points about like what would make this feel like Long Goodbye was like a touchstone for them?
For me, it was just there were certain shots. Like there was a montage set to this like needle drop like 3/4 of the way through.
Yeah.
And there was this like long shot of Margot Qualley like head to toe walking straight towards the camera. And it was very flat. And I was like, you know, this is actually achieving Long Goodbye feeling where it's just your main character is a detective, but they're just so cool. They're so themselves and just like kind of watching them. They're not even like really moving. They're just kind of like ambling, hovering in the middle of the frame, but just looking incredible. When she goes into the bar and the piano player is talking to her.
Yeah.
That where you're like, this movie is weirdly moving like a real detective noir, even though the main character is giving you off the hump energy all the time.
Yeah, those shoe leather scenes like that. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, I think so.
Do you think that the character in this movie might be the same character who is in Driveway Dolls?
I don't, because having just watched them back to back, that character is such an innocent. It's just so wide-eyed.
Right.
You know, it's kind of the justification for everything is kind of like, there's no danger here, you know, like over and over again. And
yeah, she throws herself right into a situation.
Yeah.
We know that Honey O'Donohue is from Bakersfield, and we know that Jamie is from more like the Deep South. She says what state she's from.
Yeah, well, I'm from Texas. We don't read minds. We operate on a handshake basis.
What does that mean?
Hiya, how you doing? How much for that Cadillac car? How'd you like to have oral sex? Texas!
So they're both from rural areas, but one of them's more East Coast Southern, and one of them's more West Coast.
Is this the same DP as Driveway Dolls?
Yes. The DP is Ari Wegner.
Yeah.
Who shot Lady Macbeth in 2016.
And Power of the Dog, right?
And Power of the Dog, yeah. And yeah. Zola, which is beautifully shot. Very good movie. She is an Australian cinematographer.
I thought it looked really cool.
Yeah.
Jay Todd did the storyboards. That was nice to see.
He's another one has worked on more Coen Brothers movies than the Coen Brothers camp.
There was some really nice Carter Burwell moments. Like, I feel like there was a cue when she was looking at the yearbook and a music cue at the end of their second date, where all of a sudden it was starting to do that classic Carter Burwell thing of the scene suddenly having this kind of ominous tone to it, as if you're seeing something historic taking place or something.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Kind of a paranoid feeling and a,
yeah,
just like an incredible sadness that you don't know.
Like, yeah.
You could play that scene where she enters the house at the end and when she looks at the yearbook, you could play that scene a lot of different ways. And it really comes down to the music.
That layer, the ability to go into that airspace, I think really does help balance all the jokes and all the character quirks and all the kind of specifics of location and vocabulary that they're doing.
We didn't have as deep and dark character stuff in Driveway Dolls.
Having just watched them back to back, I think it's absolutely true.
Like, bad things happen to characters in both movies, but there's a psychological component. There's stuff about these characters' upbringings and the fact that they are so attracted to each other at the beginning and then realize that they have so much in common, which is, I think, very moving. The scene in bed where it's like the camera's on a crane, but it's not doing a lot. It basically just goes from a close-up to a two-shot. Plaza and Quali are just staring up at the ceiling, talking about each other's lives. I think it's as good as anything in any Coen's film, and it's so simple, right? It's just two people in bed talking.
That is the beat. The music cue that comes on at the end of that suddenly starts to kind of expand just your awareness of what you're watching. Is the experience I have when I hear the counterintuitive Carter Burwell strings coming on.
Did you start to suspect that Plaza might be psycho?
See, in retrospect, this is the stuff where I feel like second viewing, third viewing, that seems great. Yeah, it seems like that would really, really work well.
I mean, I'll say in my first viewing, it completely, completely knocked me upside the head. Like, even when she was entering the house, like, obviously they were doing creepy house stuff, but like, I'm not even sure if I was totally aware that she was going to her house or whose house she was at. Watching it a second time, she is talking to her secretary, who, by the way, I thought did a great job. Her assistant, always trying to help her, and she's only interested in helping herself. I did not realize it was going to take that turn. I was like, oh, the turn it's taking is that it's a breakup scene. But I did not realize we were about to discover who the serial killer of the story is.
You're a good fuck, but you don't do anything socially. Super funny.
It's a mean thing to say to somebody. Especially after you just stabbed them. No, but that through line ties through the whole movie because she says, like, this is social. I'm not seeing it. At the beginning of the movie, she says, this is social. Yeah, it's a movie about a workaholic.
Yeah. Yeah, when she goes to her sister's house and her sister is domestic, the way that it feels is so claustrophobic. Those shots are incredible where they just keep crowding the frame with more and more just like,
yeah, they keep
realistic surly teenagers. Yeah, where's my charger, you know? Very honest line of dialogue.
Yeah, I think that's the cool thing about working with this DP is there's just something a little bit more like kitchen sink realist. Like obviously the scenes are beautifully lit. It's kind of like Fargo meets Lady Killers.
Also Big Lebowski. I mean, like the harder characters, like a version of Big Lebowski where you're just following around those guys that smash up his answering machine at the beginning. You know, like the second that Australian guy walked on, the blonde hair and the jean jacket, I was like, oh, this is like a really funny Coen's type of tough guy, macho guy.
Like surfer bruiser.
Yeah, so funny.
Yeah, like a guy out of Point Break, is that it? Yeah.
Absolutely out of Point Break. And also funny later in the film when that guy dies, that his replacement is such a step down. But you can tell, like, that they're looking for the same kind of guy, but just this, like, much slower and much bigger guy is there now. It's, like, really funny.
I hadn't made that connection, but yeah. It did also remind me of Punch Drunk Love, how Philip Seymour Hoffman's character has, the mattress man has all those Mormon brothers working for him.
Yeah, exactly that look.
And he's
yeah.
running the sex line.
Hey, this is Dean Trumbull for The Mattress Man. Give me a call at 370-0466. For a limited time only, D&D Mattress has queen mattress sets for $99 and king sets for $129.
Shit!
From the nation's capital, here's the McDonough Group. For two decades, the smartest minds of the Coens. And here's the moderator, me. An unrehearsed discussion amongst the greatest minds. The McDonough Group, named for H.I. McDonough and Ed McDonough from the film Raising Arizona. Today we have an amazing panel to discuss the film Honey Don't. We have two amazing returners from the episode about intertexts. We have Melissa Tuckman, writer, poet, thinker, academic, teacher. From the episode on budget-destroying effects, we have Ben Brewer, breakthrough film director, writer, visual effects genius. And from the podcast Can I Kick It, a podcast about world film and film festivals and film culture, Emilio Diaz. Welcome.
Thank you for having us.
Yeah, thank you.
Issue one, my favorite question to ask after anyone has just watched a movie, can you tell me what the plot of that movie was?
It was kind of like Rockabilly Eddington. It was a culture war in the desert. There was a PI. It started kind of conventionally with a dead woman. Then she investigated a kind of sex cult church and fell in love. And then there were twists and turns. Are we doing spoilers?
We've already spoiled it quite a bit.
I see. It reminded me a little of the end of Love Lies Bleeding. Did you guys see that?
Oh, yeah.
Because there's like this queer romance that turns out to be really dysfunctional and abusive.
Yeah, very similar. Emilio, what would you add?
I guess there's a plot line involving the main character, Honey's niece, and how she gets caught up in a sort of sex cult slash eventually you find out that it's not a sex cult. I mean, that the sex cult is a sex cult. She is not involved in the sex cult is what I mean to say. There are red herrings, things that you assume are going to be where the story ends up are not really where they end up regarding Chris Evans' character and his culpability and everything that happens. A lot of people hit on the main character.
Yeah, sure.
Apart from that, I don't think I have anything to add at this moment.
Ben, what about you?
Well, the plot was a private detective investigates a recent client's death because it seems mysterious and connects to a local evangelical church and sort of a, yeah, what would you call it? Like a Dashiell Hammett thing in Bakersfield mixed with that Russ Meyers super vixen. I'm not going to be able to add anything. I'm just repeating what has been said.
Well, you brought up Super Vixen. Who here, because Jordan sent out a link to Super Vixens, right? That's the title of the film?
Yeah.
Who watched part or all of Super Vixens?
I took a quick glance.
I would also say I took a quick glance.
Yeah, that's fine. For me...
What was everyone's... I ask, what was your off-ramp? What was the moment where you're like, you know, I'm going to move on to the next part of my day? Does everyone remember?
They were fucking to old-time religion. They were singing that song while fucking.
Okay, so I made this mistake too. So in that link that you sent, Jordan, there are two films. One was called Return to the Valley of the Ultra Vixen. No, I'm saying it wrong. Something to the Valley of the Ultra Vixen. And then Super Vixen was like track two. So I watched like 12 minutes of that really bizarre one that also kind of is like brilliant in its pornographic kind of art. And then I switched and watched the other one, which was more obviously related to Honey Don't. So I actually was shortchanged what I should have done because I was watching what amounted to a far more experimental thing. Where did you do the same thing, Melissa, that I just described? Yeah.
Yeah, and I was wondering because I was like, I don't see the connections so much other than like the editing style was a little similar.
I apologize for the red herring of my own, sending out the link that had two different movies. Yeah, and especially because they had similar titles. So that's on me. But no, I mean, for me, it was just like the scene where Quali is destroying the guy's car and putting the bumper sticker on it reminded me a lot of the scene where the main character's girlfriend is like taking an axe to his truck.
It's so funny, not to just quickly throw in there, but I literally just saw Honey Don't. My memory of her destroying that guy's car is like non-existent. I immediately just said, oh my God, this is, I'm going to kill your fucking car. This is Big Lebowski. This is where this came from. Like I was at, that's how like deeply entrenched I am in like the, but you're right. You're totally right. That scene is as much, is more clearly a homage in this new movie. But I was like, oh, that's where they got, this is what happens when you fuck a stranger in the ass, Larry. Like that's, yeah.
I'm sure they did. They got it from there too. Yeah. No, I hadn't made that connection.
What about that like Miller's Crossing hat that was just in the doorway there?
Oh,
oh yeah.
With the, abuelita's hat. Yeah. Yeah. Was that her hat?
That was her hat.
As soon as I saw that abuelita, I wrote down abuelita doomed. The hat reminded me of something. I hadn't figured out it was Miller's Crossing. I did think of Bunny by the pool when we saw the French lady lounging.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah. That's absolutely great.
I loved the moment where she said they are French, very secular. And what was, Ben, do you think they augmented the glare on her eyes, or do you think they did that in camera? That was so cool.
I was totally thinking that was a visual effect and great one. But I of course don't know. But to me, that just registers as something that you do in post.
There's like two glimmers of it. Like you see one and then she turns it and then somehow those highlights kind of flash again.
The first time it looks like her eyes are glowing like she's in Ghostbusters. And then the second time you're like, oh, I guess that's the reflection of the sun. That was at least the way I processed it.
It looked cool.
That character really enjoyed a high level of like visual execution in her story pieces, you know, like that opening. I mean, talk about like a shot that just sets you up to be like taken in by someone who really knows how to make a film. Just the sort of the unraveling of information that she walks into the shot and then kind of the reveal of the broken, you know, barrier of the road and then the crash car, like just that whole beginning kind of set you up for like this very Coen Brothers, like sort of like to a T sort of what they're famous for. And then anytime she showed up again, she kind of got a similar level of like visual sort of like idea making storytelling, visual storytelling was happening with that character a lot.
The camera loves her. She holds the frame together.
Everything just becomes like crisp and deliberate.
Yeah.
When she's on screen. What were you going to say?
Well, just note she didn't have, you know, she wasn't dealing with dialogue. So there's kind of this space that needed, the same way that No Country or Blood Simple or any of these kind of executions of visual storytelling. And actually, for that matter, like Russ Meyer, like I had never watched any of his stuff till watching the stuff, the things for this. And it's like, it's amazing the sense of that a pure cinema is emerging from pornography. Like, the restrictions being put on that filmmaker who still wants to tell a visual story. It's like, it really is quite remarkable.
Yeah. Ray and I were talking about his use of close-ups, like what he focuses on, like whether it's like a gun or a boot or a butt. he really has a fetishistic command of film craft, which is the other connection that I saw when Cher puts the ring in the pocket of her pants. Like that close up really felt like a Russ Meyer close up to me.
It's a nice opening too, because at first you think maybe she's just looting the body, which is shocking in itself. But then when you see it's not that nice of a ring and it has the cross on it, it kind of draws you into the plot. Also, did you already talk about how in the abuelita's pupil, you see the guy who's coming to murder the
grandson?
That
was so cool.
Didn't that remind you of the canyon of the shadow from the eagle, Ray?
Oh, wow. Yeah, that's awesome.
It gives him that extra moment that saves him temporarily.
Yeah, wanting to look in his grandmother's eyes for the last time.
And it was so intense. It was like as he's pulling her head up, you almost feel like she's going to start speaking, mm-hmm. at least when I was watching it. Like, for some reason, you're just like, this dead person is about to come to life. And then looking in the eye and seeing that, I feel like you're just so off balance when you see that reflection in the eye, and then it's so exciting. It's, yeah, very cool.
And that is a theme in the movie, dead people coming back to life, because there's that repeated ambiguity about, is she dead? And Margot Qualley says no, for it's kind of a non sequitur. Then that comes up several times. And then at the end, she is like really resurrected, like a Christ figure.
Oh, Qualley is, yeah.
Yeah.
Can I mention a movie that I was thinking of the whole time? Because I will admit, I saw Drive Away Dolls only very recently. It had sort of passed me by, and then only recently I caught up with it.
Yeah.
And I had a nice time with it. You know, it's funny, it's quirky, it's fast. And then I went into this movie expecting it to be similar, and then was sort of struck by how much more deliberately paced it is than Drive Away Dolls. It's a lot slower of a movie.
Despite it also being 90 minutes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But the movie I was thinking of the whole time, who I think is like, I mean, just another guy who I think is coming at it from the same perspective of being like a Russ Meyer fan, is Death Proof. Of just a movie that, you know, is playing on certain, you know, kitschy tropes from the 70s and 60s and sort of remixing them in its own way. Obviously, I think Honey Don't is coming at it from a different perspective. But when Death Proof is also a movie I saw for the first time this year. And that's another movie that I was struck by how like deliberately paced in it. Like Death Proof is a movie that has like five scenes. If you when you watch it and you really think about it, it's so like lengthy and it really takes its time. And so it was interesting to think about Ethan Coen, you know, obviously a person who worked at the same era or probably coming at the same thing at the same time as Tarantino, finally getting to make a movie like this.
Yeah, I also thought of Death Proof as like just similar in a sensibility. Although I think I talked about this with Jordan at one point, like when I watched The Big Lebowski now, I do think it has a lot of borrowings from Tarantino, just like the kitschy 90s vibe.
Yeah. And the way the comedy and the dialogue kind of work with the crime story.
I think there's a difference. Well, not difference, but I think I definitely see that Death Proof connection just because it seems like these filmmakers, these directors, it's like they all have this experience where they make some movie or series of movies that they consider really challenging and difficult and a ton of work and maybe not worth, you know, maybe they didn't quite, and then they didn't quite get the reward they wanted from it or whatnot. And then they always kind of like say like, oh, I just want to make a movie for that's like fun.
Yeah.
It feels like there's always, filmmakers are always like trying to make movies fun for themselves. And this movie felt like that. This movie felt like I'm going to write scenes I want to shoot. I'm going to call some people to be in it. I'm going to get a little money because I can. And then, but there's like, and it's an interesting, weird vibe because like Big Lebowski, and this is something I really noticed, is like the Coen brothers, they are so setting focused, right? Like Big Lebowski, it's like this aggression will not stand. It's the Gulf War. It's like, you know, there is a man of his time. You know, sometimes there's a man. And this movie, it's like, you know, I want them all to be dressed in as like it's the 70s, but they have iPhones. It's like, okay. It's like, cause they just do. Like, I just want to have fun and make something that's like fun. And so I think Death Proof kind of felt that way to me too. I don't think that when he's doing his, like, when Tarantino's doing, like, he just came out to say Inglourious Basterds is his, like, he considers it his masterpiece. He's like, well, that's probably not the movie where you have everyone talk about Vanishing Point for 20 minutes. You know, it's like, so I think these types of movies are very interesting from a totally like inchoate sense I have, that it's like these big deal filmmakers who just want to see if making a movie could be fun and easy and just like, let's just do this thing. I felt that throughout this because it violates so many little things that the Coen brothers, my imagination of them would be like, we never do that. We never do that. And it was breaking a lot of those rules that I have from knowing their work.
Okay, how about this? Issue two. How is this movie different from a Coen Brothers movie?
For me, it's like, this is going to be very unspecific, but like at times, the film is executed with the visual, the kind of lapidary visual, you know, crossing off the storyboards on the poster board thing that we kind of think of them. And then there's other times where it's like, this movie has, you know, such a variety of visual execution to it, story visual execution. And I think that's what makes it interesting to me, because they don't, when they're together, they don't do that. Like when they're together, they are, for better or worse, this unit producing something perfect. And I don't mean perfect like every film they make is, you know, resistant to critique. I just mean like there is just something about the execution that feels like consensus.
Trying to be the very best. Like
just the very best, yeah.
Yeah.
I think it kind of floats between this grammar that we've grown to really know about their films as a duo.
I had some thoughts about how the Ethan-Trisha collabs are different. I guess going back to what Ben said, I do kind of miss like the sociological specificity of the like shared Joel-Ethan vision. Like in Lou and Davis, we're so in Greenwich Village in the 60s, or like in Burn After Reading, we're so in this like elite DC world. And I do feel like that's missing a little from Drive Away Dolls and Honey Don't. And maybe that is freeing in some ways. But I don't know, I felt a little disappointed by it too. Like I wish Drive Away Dolls had felt a little more of that moment. Because it's set in 1999. It doesn't really feel so much like 1999. And in Honey Don't, I mean, we are in, it's Bakersville, right?
Yeah.
So there's like a lot of visuals of the town, but it didn't really feel like so grounded in a specific location to me. But then I guess one thing that's also really interesting about these movies is like, I think there was kind of this like implicit natalism in a lot of Coen movies, like obviously Raising Arizona and Fargo. Oh Brother, Where Art Thou? It's kind of like a remarriage. But even like Llewyn Davis and Big Lebowski, it's like part of the happiness of the ending is like there's a baby on the way, possibly.
Mm-hmm.
And so I guess it's cool to see Ethan just trying something that's not like so heteronormative, like in the parlance of our times. It's interesting. I don't know if it's like a fully successful experiment, but it's just interesting to see like his dialogue style applied to like a very different moral universe.
And what is what do you feel is like the definition of the moral universe here?
Well, I think Drive Away Dolls was kind of like more successful for me because that was like such a classic love story where it's like someone who is more liberated and someone who's more uptight and they complement each other. So really it's a movie about freedom because at the end it's like the freedom to choose love and the freedom to commit to a marriage. So like that's like a very compelling story. I think here like Quali and Aubrey Plaza, their characters are actually really similar. They have similar backstories. And so I think it was trying to do something with like they've made different moral choices. Like Plaza has become, or MG has like decided to become vindictive and violent. And Honey has decided to be a force for good. But I don't really understand why they made those choices. So I don't feel like the morality comes through as clearly.
Yeah. What about you, Emilio? Do you have any big differences?
If you look at what you would call the Coen brothers' joint filmography, if you would be asked like what their influences are, I think you would rarely say something past like Technicolor. You know, you would say like a lot of like Preston Sturges, Howard Hawks, Dashiell Hammett, like a lot of stuff from the early part of the 20th century. Versus like both Drive Away Dolls and this movie more do feel like they're more in conversation with the latter part of the 20th, where it's like it's in conversation with these 70s like, you know, elevated porn movies, and it's in conversation with, you know, wacky stuff in the 90s. Speaking to what Ben said, you know, I think there is some component of like, you know, thinking about this and Death Proof. It's like, oh, so, well, somebody wants to make a movie that's easy to them. Well, they made something very reminiscent of like a film from the 70s, which is probably when they were children or teen or like coming of age. So there is probably some like familial feeling in these styles and tones and rhythms of filmmaking. Another thing I thought about was Quali as the like sort of protagonist of both of these movies, and how like kind of unlike most Coen's protagonists, she she is, especially in Honey Don't. Like, I feel like usually when you have somebody in the center of a mystery in, like, a Coen's movie, rarely you see somebody, like, in charge of it as she is. Like, even Marge in Fargo, yeah, with obviously, like, sort of gets the job done and it's sort of a moral center. It's not like she's, like, 100% on the case on, you know, the people who are doing the bad things the whole time. She is sometimes lost in it. And obviously, Quali Honey's, like, at the end of this movie, it gets lost in the plot to a certain extent and doesn't get the full picture of what was happening because, you know, obviously she never understands what the French woman was doing. But still, she is much more, like, you know, large and in charge than what I feel like most Coen protagonists who are sort of drowned in the world that they're creating tend to be.
To compare her to Tom Reagan, like, Tom Reagan is drinking himself to death and has huge debts that are constantly, and like a gambling problem that are like constantly like this like side problem in his life. Whereas Honey can afford to pay a secretary.
Right. What about the Brolin character in Hail Caesar? That's a guy who has real talents, is a kind of fixer, is also going through a personal inner turmoil.
That's true. That's one of Hail Caesar I haven't seen in a little bit. Though I did think about Hail Caesar a little bit when watching this movie, and just in terms of its view on Christianity or like American Christianity. But I feel like even Brolin is sort of reactive to his circumstances in that movie, even if he's doing a good job in a way that Honey is not. Honey is sort of creating her own circumstances to a large extent in this movie.
Yeah, and the sort of the action, such as it is in Hail Caesar, kind of gets split between Brolin as Mannix and Aaron Reich's Hobie Doyle.
Yeah, and I think to another extent, I was thinking about Lebowski also a lot when watching this movie. And the thing that's sort of the miracle about Lebowski, a movie I've seen like 12 times at this point, is that that is a movie that, while it feels shaggy, you know, it has sort of a plot that is, you know, it's about hippies and stoners. So even though it feels shaggy, it is actually tight as a drum. Like, you watch all of those scenes and it's like every single person is hitting their line at the exact same moment. The dialogue's rat-a-tat, even if it's said through like, you know, slow down voices and vocal fry. Versus this, there are a lot of scenes that feel airy, that there are a lot of just like quiet people taking pauses between lines of dialogue in a way that I don't traditionally associate with a Coen Brothers movie.
Yeah, the scene Ray and I were talking about, the scene where Quali's dad comes to visit her, and I mean, he doesn't really beg for forgiveness so much as just like beg to be allowed back in, but without saying sorry about anything. And just like his performance, like the only thing I could compare it to is Tom Waits in Scruggs, in terms of just like how much they kind of let him sort of say the same thing over and over again and kind of keep kind of like vibrating with grief. I mean, maybe Mike Yanagita too, but again, like that scene is also like, I think like what you're saying is like Coen's in the 90s. It's like if they have a character go off the rails, it's actually still within this sort of like staged kind of like window.
Presentation.
Yeah, yeah. Presentation. Yeah. Something else I wanted to mention too is Soderbergh was on the Team Deacons podcast recently, and he said that you can direct a movie in a way that's staged or framed, and you can direct a movie in a way that's captured, right? And I think something that you were saying, Ben, is that you felt like more of this movie maybe felt like it was the latter. Does that dichotomy like have any salience? Like, do you think that there's something different about the way these movies are put together that feels more like they like sort of just captured things and like as if they were like a documentary of what was going on?
This is going to sound like more critical than I mean it to, but I think nothing about this movie was as scrutinized as anything they've ever done. Like, I think that in a kind of a beautiful way, like just like it, like because the script, like, yeah, talk about like Big Lebowski. You're right. It's as tight as a drum, and structurally, it's a beautiful script. And that's hard to do when you're trying to create the sense of this, like, you know, trying to create a world, trying to, you know, follow these characters in this very strange, like you said, kind of shaggy feeling journey. But yeah, the structure, that's perfect. This one, the structure is very bizarre at times. There's also a feeling that maybe like a bit overachievement on the Chris Evans stuff. Like I was like so in love with the Chris Evans material and his character and just everything about the observation there. And to not see that being, not seeing that level of kind of like novel character creation happening for the lead, I was like, well, I feel kind of guilty about this. Like I'm like really digging like this horrific, you know, evangelical guy. And I'm not nearly as compelled by, say, Margaret Qualley visiting her sister. Like I didn't really have a sense of what that had to do with anything outside of the fact that obviously later her niece gets kidnapped. So yeah, I think but it's a balance. I'm not saying it felt like loose. I think it's just there were parts that felt like that certain level of like really like neurotic kind of execution. And then there's other parts that just felt like, oh, we've written a really funny, good scene. We're just going to kind of cover it. There's like a sequence where she's looking for the niece and it's kind of cross fading between Margaret Qualley and bus stops and things like that. And it goes on like noticeably like 5 seconds too long. And I just was like, maybe that's the point, is that like, I think anyone watching would be like, hey, we get it. But there it is. It's like 10 seconds too long. So that's to me the thing of it. That's the vibiness of it to me, is like that it's very much just happening. And it doesn't feel like anybody was really sort of neurotically figuring out if the script was perfect. It's just like, no, we got some great stuff here. We got some great things to do. There's some great, you know, let's just do it. That's what it felt like to me.
And just to point out, like we've talked about how the meticulous montage is a term we made up for when a Coen's character is putting stuff together through a series of shots where you kind of see this intricate step-by-step building of something. And in that sequence, it's like, she's not making any progress. Like she's just sort of going around and showing the picture, but it's not like she like gets like one clue and then takes it somewhere else. It's much more an internal process for her. She's working through things in her head more than she's actually doing anything. Cause she's basically hitting brick walls with all the places that she's going.
Yeah. And if you think of just like musical montages in other movies, it's like stuff from Oh Brother, Where Art Thou, where everything, there's like exposition in every single shot.
Yes.
And every single shot, the way it ends and the next one starts, lets you know that there was a drawing done of it, because it's all falling perfectly. And the whole sequence becomes like, symphonic. Whereas this was more, I think what you're describing is really the feeling of like, oh, they just kind of rolled the camera for a while. And then someone later in editing was like, oh, I think I can use this piece and put it here and then take this other part and put it here, which is totally different than someone setting out with like each piece of the mosaic in their mind.
Yes.
And I just want to say, I feel like I'm talking too much, but I just want to say, like, I don't think that there's a value judgment inherent in either approach. Like something can feel too planned out and something can feel too unplanned, but like it's really just like different approaches.
It's just striking to see in their movies.
Yeah. And it's also a little striking in comparison to Drive Away Dolls, which is like so like the editing of that movie is so kinetic, where it's like it has like wipes and like shots transition to each other. Where I was talking to my roommate and like podcast co-host Colin about it, and he was like, it feels very Sam Raimi versus this movie, which is, you know, airy in part probably just because they have different reference points and they want to make different points. It's also a more, I don't know if thoughtful is the right word for this movie than Drive Away Dolls, but it is more like there's more sitting with it than there is in Drive Away Dolls. Drive Away Dolls, every single second something is happening on screen. There's a lot of time in Honey Dome where stuff is not happening pretty deliberately. And you can tell it, like, even from the opening shot of just, like, you know, the quiet, the walking down the cliff, looking at, taking the finger off the cross versus the, like, the wackiness of the Pascal stuff at the beginning of Drive Away Dolls.
The characters in this movie have history and regrets and stuff that they're carrying around with them, where I feel like everyone in Drive Away Dolls is traveling pretty light.
Yeah. I mean, that is a movie about excitement and energy, and this is not a movie about that. This is a movie about people sort of sitting in it and sort of thinking about this sort of rundown place they're from and how this all binds them together in a certain way.
Yeah, that opening with the "we got to get out of this place" makes it pretty clear. It's like they're in the bad place.
What did you guys think of the opening credits?
I do have notes, and I did just write, oh, they're doing the Entourage opening credits.
Ray compared them to Panic Room.
Panic Room is another good one.
The amazing thing about the Panic Room opening is you can see the next credits, like, in the background of the shot, and then the continuity of, like, it weaves around the corner, and it is the right street in New York City. It's so funny.
They made me feel a little carsick, honestly. I kind of wish they had just been still shots.
Yeah, I kind of wish that they had either been moving or still, but the fact that they're moving, the fact that you have amateurish or improvisational footage and then you have stuff tracked into them was cool. But then the fact that it had the freeze frames also, to me, felt kind of like maybe they did the tracks and some of the credits were hard to read, so they added the freeze frames later. But, like, something about that felt like a little bit jumbled up. But on the other hand, I think it speaks to the what we were just talking about, which is, like, the willingness to have stuff that feels imperfect, which is, like, kind of refreshing also.
Yeah, usually everything's so clean. It was really messy.
Also, kind of the fact that it was like shot on just like different formats, or like my thought was it was maybe licensed stock from, like, you know, different Southern California towns that had the right kind of Bakersfield look. So, like, but that, like, it's so, it just, like, immediately announced something to me about, like, what this movie was going to be, essentially, which was, it's funny because I think the comping of everyone's names and all the credits was, like, really quite impressive. Like, some of them are just, like, really great comps, you know, VFX comps. But then you're very distracted by the fact that it's, like, obviously licensed footage, or it's, like, shot on an iPhone. Not iPhone, that's maybe a bit, but it's, like, very clearly not, like, this was not part of the principal photography or even, like, a, you know, properly funded additional thing. It's just like, yeah, we just need. And then the feeling that you're like, I'm looking at the oil derricks, I'm getting the, it's all this kind of period stuff, but every now and then there's, like, a Toyota Sienna in the shot, and you're like, wait, that's, like, a minivan from now. And then you're like, wait, but oh no, but we're, like, really focused. So, like, and then the rest of the movie kind of having this, like, myopia of being like, we're going to be looking at old things, but people are going to have iPhones. Like, it's just, it's like, I know I've said that already, but I just, like, the second I saw that happening, I thought that's really different from, that's very unusual. And it never settled in. Like, it stayed weird for me the whole time. That anachronistic, like, we are just going to frame out the, you know, Jimmy John's sub shop and just focus on the motel from 1965. Like, that's without it actually being period or any kind of greater justification. I just found that felt very, like, just indulging I just want to do it this way without really justifying.
Just to gently push back on that, and
Please
spent
do.
Less time in California than I think you or Ray, but, like, isn't that also just kind of what parts of California feel like? Like, that you see stores hanging out from the sort of middle of the 20th century that just seem a lot older than you expect to see.
Yeah, I think it's like the, you know, the scenes in her sister's house felt very modern. You know, there's like details, contemporary details, the fact that they're like looking for their phone chargers. You know, it's like that all felt very like parts of Burn After Reading. You're like, I can't believe they're putting such ugly contemporary stuff in their movie.
And Chivo's shooting it too also, so it like feels different.
Yeah, I just feel like there, Ben is right. There is almost like a Brazil type somewhere in the 20th century. Like they're creating a decade a little bit by being like, at this period in time, everyone drove cars in the 80s and 90s and wore cool clothes from the 70s, 80s, and 90s. But it was definitely post-COVID. Like that's the one detail, I think, like when Billy Eichner is like references COVID and you're like, okay, this is a modern day film. But yeah, they're creating kind of stylized aesthetic experience that is kind of outside of a real place.
That's a great example, the COVID line, because it's only in there because it's funny. Like you can't just like, and it is funny, but I could easily see an argument where it's like, is that really worth it to put that in there? Because it's a laugh, but like, what are, why? And but the whole movie, I think, kind of has that sort of like freeness to it. Like things are just there because they're like, why not?
But was that our indication that it was contemporary? To me, that was the clue that said this is set in the contemporary moment, post-COVID.
Yeah, that's what I thought.
Yeah. I do wonder, because towards the end when, you know, Quali and Plaza, Honey and MG, they're about to get to their final confrontation. There's talk about MG's house being run down and that being sort of reflective of this town.
Yeah.
And I do wonder if there is maybe like some threads that it's trying to tie together about this town, about a town that is sort of run down. And so it has some of this rustic aesthetic just because it's like a place that time left behind. But at the same time, you know, it's 2024, 25, whenever this is set. So it's so there is, you know, that sort of conversation. I think the movie maybe could use a little bit more of that, of just like trying to speak to this specific place and time. I think what Melissa said earlier is true, where it's like it is a little unmooring. I don't think you have a very specific sense of place, but I think there are like threads of the specific place that this movie is trying to build that you can sort of pull together if you read into it enough.
Yeah, I wish we had gotten to spend more time in MG's house, because there was some kind of like gothic Flannery O'Connor stuff going on there. I thought it was interesting that we never actually see what happens in the basement. A lot of the most horrifying stuff happens off screen. We also don't see Chris Evans actually manipulating anyone. We see him having sex and we see his manipulative rhetoric in the sermon, but we don't really see the true horrors of what's going on in that cult. The things that really could have been like horror movie fodder are left off screen. Do you think they did enough to set up that MG was going to turn out to be a villain?
I think it was a huge misdirect. So like for me, it threw me for a loop the first time I watched it. I do think that in a kind of rapid fire way, they handle it pretty well just in the actual sort of unraveling of that confrontation. But I guess it's kind of like the whole thing, like the first date, second date, third date. Like it's like a joke about that. Like you like somebody a lot at the beginning and then you kind of realize... They're not all that. And it's like, it's.
And the cycle continues because at the end of the film, she's picking up the French assassin.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Somebody who might like literally have skeletons in their closet.
Okay. So can we talk about that? Okay. So I've seen it twice now and I want to say, I think that she knows who that woman is because she saw her leave the church on her motorcycle. And I think that woman also, Cher turns and sees her blue car when she leaves. So I think they're both trying to set each other up at the end of the movie.
Hmm.
It's a very suspenseful ending.
Yeah, that's interesting. I guess that is true. They both have seen each other in a way that sort of may indicate that there's something that's going to go on between them.
They're kind of the two coolest characters in the movie, like the most capable. It feels right that they end up together, just even like in that last moment.
Although if Honey is setting her up, then that would prove that Honey truly has a good moral compass, because even though she's attracted to this woman, and this woman, I believe, killed the Chris Evans character, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So they have like an enemy in common. But if she is trying to set up the French woman, then it's like she's truly committed to doing the right thing.
Or she wants to get, she wants to have a one night stand and then maybe figure out a way to take down the cartel. Like it might be both.
Oh, Jordan, remember the thing that we wanted to ask? What were they picking up in that scene? They're picking up, was it corn or was it teeth off the ground?
Yeah, when the long haired guy is sort of is not long for this world. He's already gotten hit in the face with an iron, and he's like on the ground, but he's like rooting around in the silverware. I thought he was
for his teeth.
Is it his teeth?
That's what I thought.
All right. Maybe I've just been overruled on this. The McDonough group has spoken.
Emilio, what do you think?
I think it's teeth also, yes.
Oh, wow. 4-1, Jordan.
All right, he's trying to pick up his teeth.
I think that there's like, that to me was a double-edged sword of like, it's like Cormac McCarthy like in gave them, it's like he has possessed them so that when they make scenes like that, they are these like spectacular, like violent operas that show you things you've never thought of about two people trying to fucking kill each other. So out of place in this movie for me, but like in its like, maybe I just needed to like get more exploitation-y about it. And like, I think maybe if we had kicked off a little bit earlier with something to tell me we were going to have something like that, but truly that scene of him of Hector being attacked, I mean, that's like just straight kind of No Country level brutality. And then again with Aubrey Plaza and Margaret Qualley, like another sort of just absolutely elegant, beautifully brutal sequence in a movie that you are not on that frequency at all. And it's a little bit like, what the hell? But it's so good. I thought it was, and it reminded me of Hitchcock too. Maybe it's because I just watched Torn Curtain, but there's like, you know, just thinking about the like directors who are clearly not fetishists of gore, they want to do something with violence that's going to actually kind of get at you better than if they just showed you something like, if it had that vibe to me.
Is that the first Coen scene where it's two women fighting brutally?
I'm flipping the Rolodex. I'm trying to think.
I think so.
Yeah. Yeah, I can't think of one.
That would be my guess also.
They don't even like to show women getting killed.
Mm.
Highly averse to it. In the To the White Sea script also. That's a line that they go to a couple times and then pull back from.
Yeah, you know, with the Plaza's death, I did think about every time they've depicted somebody getting a bullet through the head. I think that's a trick they've played often. Like I think of Totoro's End and Miller's Crossing. Fargo has a lot of people getting shot in the head. Obviously, Burn After Reading, a iconic person getting shot in the face movie.
Scruggs also.
Yeah, Scruggs.
I love the kettle gag in this.
Yeah.
Where you think that kettle stopped the bullets. So funny.
It's just like that sort of, the specificity of their violence. Yeah, just those sorts of flourishes I find interesting.
Yeah, I saw like a behind the scenes with their practical effects people, and they're like, you know, it's not quantity on their movies. It's always just trying to make it, the squibs, really weird and memorable. I know like in the sound design phase, they're always talking about like, make it hurt. You want the audience to feel how bad this violence feels just for a moment. Yeah,
absolutely. Obviously I need to shout out, obviously No Country. There's a lot of holes being put in people's head in No Country.
Unfair.
I was thinking about that make it hurt edict, when the guy's getting dragged through the parking lot and then he hits the cement light pole. I thought that was like, just, I went, ugh, in the theater.
That was really good. There's something about that shot that's really, really disturbing. And what it is it's the rigidity of the body. I don't know. Did you notice that?
Yeah.
When he hits the thing, the fact that his limbs have no give, they don't have the ragdoll thing, which they like his legs are like stick straight.
Yeah.
It's so that really makes you feel it. Even though it's probably not accurate, because I think you would just be floppy as hell, but there's something about it that kind of rigor mortis rigidity of hitting it. You're like, oh, fuck, that was really bad.
Ben, were you doing any of the math on how they would have done that effect? Like, do you think they had a dummy, or what do you think they did?
Yeah, my guess is that it was a dummy, and then who knows? My sense would be that it would be something that you'd probably film. You wouldn't be that thrilled with it because generally, right, as we know from watching movies, you're kind of cutting on things like that as quickly as possible and just using the parts you need while they're holding on it. So my guess is that maybe it was something that was a practical gag that was then delivered, I would guess, to a visual effects artist to like make it work and make it like kind of. But I don't know, that dummy itself, it might have, what I'm describing might have just been a matter of a certain type of convincing body delivered that wasn't have play in the limbs, and so it just looked really weird and fucking visceral to see it hit that thing. But I'm sure there's some wire removal to eliminate what was actually allowing it to like get pulled into the thing or whatnot. Looked like there was definitely some part of dust added.
Yeah.
That scene connected to Driveaway Dolls too, because the one goon kills the other goon because he's come on to him, or maybe they've had sex.
Yeah.
And it's similar when the younger man, Billy Eichner's boyfriend, comes on to him and he reacts violently. Are we supposed to be able to figure out who Billy Eichner's boyfriend was meeting for a date?
I don't think it's specified, actually. I don't think we ever see the date show up.
And Margaret Qualley tells him not to look into it. But I think it would have been more satisfying if that had connected to the other plots.
It does feel like a dangling thread. Although, like, on the other hand, like, maybe what's going to give this movie its staying power is that there's stuff to chew on. Like, that there are, like, things you turn over in your head, kind of like No Country. Okay, let's do issue 3. How was Corinne connected to M.G. Falcone by the end of the movie?
She was so Aubrey Plaza was a serial killer who was motivated by weakness in women. So when she overheard that Margaret Qualley wasn't going to do anything about the abusive boyfriend, that put a target on the weak, the quote unquote weak, woman, figure of her obsession, which would be the niece, the Corinne. And so,
if she had her over for tea, how come she didn't kill her?
Yeah, I think, again, this is like where we're just having fun. Because the implication was that she kidnapped her off the bus at the bus stop. You know, there wasn't, who knows? There's any number of ways, you know, they had met. She's like, oh, come back. Let's calm down. Let's have a cup of tea, you know.
My guess would be something along the line of like, well, she's a policewoman. So she is in a position to either offer help or put leverage on people in those sorts of situations. And that might have been the sort of thing that got her into the room initially, of just being like, well, I know about this situation, I'm going to do something about it. And that sort of brought Karen to her. And then how she doesn't kill her, that could be, you know, it could be to some extent trying to lure Qualley in, maybe trying to make this seem like a case that needs a resolution versus something that is unresolved that Qualley would keep looking into. Like if her body just appeared somewhere, then Qualley would just like blame somebody else and keep it going. But to some extent, she wants to sort of have this confrontation with Qualley.
Yeah.
Yeah, I thought MG had kidnapped her, was keeping her in the basement, was torturing her and planning to kill her. And again, it goes back to like the moral point, which the movie's trying to make, although I don't think it completely comes through clearly, which is that like if you've been abused and if you've faced homophobia, you have choices. You can be a force for good or you can become vindictive and accuse people of not doing enough socially. I think that word socially is really important for the Coens. Like it comes up in multiple movies and it came up multiple times in Honey Don't.
That's a great line. She says, you're not doing enough socially. Like I thought that was...
Yeah.
Maude says to Lebowski, I don't want to know the father socially.
And she says, this is social, right?
That could be.
She makes the bizarre assertion that her going to check out this dead body is social because the woman was not a client, technically.
I'll maybe use this social point to sort of tie it to another thought I had with the movie. Like throughout this conversation, I've been sort of trying to think about how does this movie engage with, you know, 2020, whenever it's set. And there's a runner about Qualley not having, or telling people that she doesn't have a phone, but at one point you do see her like have an iPhone. And I think there's maybe something being said there about like independence and sort of how there's a freedom that you can have disconnected from a phone rather than, you know, always being available to people, which to a certain extent makes you beholden to somebody. And her expression of independence is sort of telling people that she doesn't have a phone because then she's not beholden to anybody contacting her. Another thing I thought about where it's like the sort of douchey evangelical Christianity does seem to be a very much, I mean, I assume to a certain extent it's existed throughout the entirety of evangelical Christianity, but the sort of Chris Evans in this movie take on it, it does seem similar to, you know, things that are happening in California these days of just like, you know, bro out, we're all chill here vibe, Christian religion.
Like youth pastors and how they operate. Yeah.
Where was the, because she told Charlie, who's going with Charlie Kelly? What was his character's name? She told Charlie from It's Always Sunny in Philadelphia that she didn't have a phone. Did she tell someone, I don't remember where else she mentioned, she told someone she wasn't phone having. Or was it that she told him multiple times, I don't have a phone?
But she does have a phone at the end, right?
Yeah,
she's always had a cell phone. She's always had a modern iPhone. It's just that this is one of her many strategies for deflecting the hitting on of her by men in her life.
Yeah, but there's also, you know, another undercurrent of like anti-technology as with her Rolodex, how she had the Rolodex instead of having like a computer with any of that information on.
Yeah.
There does seem to be a, like if it's shown through the character herself, like you saying that she doesn't seem to want to assimilate technology as much as a person her age obviously would. There's this kind of question, I think a bigger question of filmmakers not knowing what to do with iPhones and crap like that. And, you know, what's his face?
Aster?
No, the other guy. You know who I'm talking
Frager?
About. The guy. Yes. No, the other guy. The guy.
The Nosferatu.
Yes.
Hager, oh my God. You guys know. It was a big like clickbait quote. Yeah.
Yeah. He had a clickbait quote where he said, I'll never do anything outside of period because I can't stand the idea of setting up a shot where I have to film someone like holding on a phone texting. And, you know, I think it's understandable, right? In a sense. But I think when you talk about the Coens, Ethan Coen, you're talking about a person who was reared making stories in a pre, you know, what are their actual contemporary works? Because obviously they have their period works and their contemporary works, but like in general, they're kind of like floating in this space that's either relevant to the films they grew up loving or relevant to just the time they grew up in. And there's not really much violation in there. Now we're like in a point where like there's actual, like truly, I think there's stuff that is not being assimilated into like the current, you know, Big Lebowski feels like two filmmakers who actually were broke in the Valley in 1988 or something. You know, it's like there's an epochal thing that this movie is the first time I ever noticed where it's like, yeah, people are going to have the phone, but I don't really know what to tell you about it because I don't use one. This has totally missed me. And even if it is part of my life, like I have absolutely no use for it in trying to weave it into a story the way it absolutely would exist.
Yeah, they only use the phone to make calls.
Yeah.
You don't
see. There's no checking social media. There's no following the abusive boyfriend on Instagram to see if he's telling the truth. I mean, these things, as our Nosferatu friend would say, is like kind of might nauseate you, but they certainly are. We're in like a vibeless time. And so if you make a movie about now, like you just, you can't just pretend it doesn't exist, you know?
I always think that like, you know, if you make a film right now, then it becomes a period film in like 10 years.
Yeah. Cause it's like their latest contemporary film is Burn After Reading. And that is a movie that sort of feels like the time it was made at and set in. Like, you know, it feels very Blackberry-y, to borrow another term from my roommate.
Yes.
Just talking about, he loves talking about Blackberry movies as an era.
Well, it's focused on a piece of physical, not to interrupt you, but it's focused on a piece of physical media being important. Like, that was the last year you could ever do that.
Yeah, and dating websites that are on like a CRT monitor.
Yeah,
people having two landlines in their house, like the landline and then the like landline in the basement for Tilda Swinton's office number or whatever.
Burn After Reading is kind of about like how America feels like it has no purpose after the Cold War. It's pretty late to be talking about like after the Cold War. Isn't that movie from like 2008?
Yeah,
but I mean, if you started talking about that now, I think you would lose people. It doesn't feel as pertinent.
Yeah, well, that movie sort of prefigured the whole Edward Snowden thing, right? Like, mm-hmm. It's like that movie was actually like, it felt late to be doing a Cold War movie. And then in retrospect, like it almost feels like it was early in terms of like making a movie about how the global war on terror was just like creating like a superstructure of like fucking idiots who are trying to like clean things up, but are also constantly causing problems just like with like their messy personal lives.
What did we learn, Palmer?
I don't know, sir.
I don't fucking know either. I guess we learned not to do it again.
Yes, sir.
I'm fucked if I know what we did.
Yes, sir. It's hard to say.
Just to kind of close out, is there like a lasting image or a lasting scene that you feel is going to like stick with you after this watch? Like, and what are you going to take away from this movie that you want to take with you?
I mean, for me, it's the green lipstick on the teacup, just because I'm still thinking about how ragged and unclear that connection was, like how that kind of makes me think of like sugar in the hotel room in No Country. I like when a movie has stuff that kind of feels like it drags a little bit funny and doesn't totally all fit together. But then I'm also just like thinking more about what happened off camera, like what scenes are missing from this movie. Maybe what was in the script that didn't, you know, maybe something got cut. Yeah, I think there's like a lot more to chew on. As much as I really liked Driveway Dolls and I really liked rewatching it, but I felt like with this movie, I really got a sense of like the creative partnership flexing its muscles and kind of charting its own course. So, yeah. What about you, Amelia?
So a shot, a scene I found interesting is the man who you later find out is a Honey's father, when he is at the fast food restaurant looking over at Corinne, and then the shot that is her coming up to the bus stop, slowly revealing him, her being scared, him getting up saying, I love you, her running away, fade to black. That felt very complete and satisfying in a way. I thought that was a very like funnily, but also tensely staged sequence. I think it sort of speaks to an interesting thing about the movie, about sort of both with Quali's father and Chris Evans, of just like these two men who are sort of presented villainously and or violent, that then towards the end you sort of realize are marginal players in the plot of this movie that is mostly enacted by women on kind of all sides. It's sort of the French lady shoots Chris Evans, so she's in charge of that sort of end. The people dying are MG, so that's where she has control, and the person investigating is Quali, and sort of how its relationship to how it uses those men in the plot. I think you can see it through the lens of that one scene.
I don't have a particular scene or image in mind, but I think I'm going to continue to ponder what Emilio is saying about whether Honey has her shit together or not. Because I think about like my favorite noirs, like The Long Goodbye and Chinatown and The Big Lebowski. Like, you have these PIs that are caught up in this absurd world, and like we kind of are there with them and their impotence, and that's what's interesting. It's like undermining a traditional masculine authority figure. It's like someone who's kind of lost. And I think this movie maybe wanted to do that with Honey a little bit, but it also wants Honey to be empowered because she's a female detective. And I think I would like to see her disempowered a little more. I think we're still awaiting like the female version of that PI. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, the total mess. Yeah, maybe that'll be the third one.
Do we know anything about the third one?
We know it's called Go Beavers.
Okay.
Oh my god.
Ben, anything you're holding on to?
I just will totally second what Melissa just said. I think that there felt like there was this reticence to I don't know how the like labor got divided, because like it feels like, yeah, sort of the, not even just because it would be fitting of the tradition of the Marlowe or the whoever you know Sam Spade or the dude, whoever you like in these stories, like that is the tradition, but it's also just, I think, a very plainly characterization thing, especially if you know you're going to have these hilarious, you know, sort of classic bantering, you know, ebullient scenes with men that are going to be kind of like doing the funny thing, but then we're going to cut to kind of a less flawed, characterful kind of approach with our protagonist. Yeah, it seemed kind of like an odd decision. I don't really know where the probity was coming from there. But my thing, I think, was... two things. One, I think that Aubrey Plaza's performance is really worth mentioning, because I think knowing what she ultimately is to the story, I think she was playing that. She was playing that in a way that made that ending possible. I think that there was easy to imagine another actor not helping out what could be a very discordant sort of reveal, and I think she did a great job of inhabiting a self-loathing in all of her scenes. It's kind of like under the surface, just a little bit of like a, you know, so props to that. I also just loved her line when they say, we better get out here before we get arrested. What, for getting to know each other? I thought that was a great line, delivered really well. But my real thing was probably just taking out that sequence of where Hector's going to get done, because with the Abuelita, a few things, because I really appreciated that, back to what you were saying about sound and making people feel it. I really appreciated that the one time we meet Hector, we know he can throw fists. Like, that's the one thing we got to learn about him is that, like, he can freak the fuck out and punch the shit out of someone, right? So, like, so we know that he can fight. That's the only thing they've really told us about this guy. The next thing they've told us is that he's going to be killed. And so, yeah, I can't help it. I think that whole sequence is kind of perfection in terms of just, I do think it's totally outside of the movie in a way, but I think that it's, the visual execution of it is great from the very first shot, which is this total Hitchcock wide shot of him talking to his grandmother. And you know we're only there for one reason, and it is the bomb under the table. And so knowing to hang out in that wide shot for his whole conversation with his grandmother was really excellent. And then yeah, I think everything that kind of, all the visual choices in there were, just felt really, really just solid filmmaking type.
The laundry hanging scene is
amazing.
It's a new entry in the Perfect Quiet catalog.
Mm-hmm.
It's nice. It's really nice. There's sort of a, when he comes back in and you got the Miller's Crossing hat and then, you know, grandmother down on the ground, it's like, because we haven't been in that movie, you like almost like, if you short filmify that, if you were just like, I'm just going to show you some filmmaking, we're in a film class, I'm just going to show you filmmaking, I think the hanging of the, on the laundry rack, or taking the things, the blankets off the laundry rack, going and seeing it, I think all that would really hit even better if you just sort of showed it as an exercise in visual storytelling. There's something about how it sat in the actual sort of like tone of the movie that wasn't quite as, because we're not in Miller's Crossing, we're not in No Country. Like, it's a different type of, like, to me, it was a different type of kind of tone and energy and all that. But yeah, so that's my rambling answer to that simple question.
I think it's a great answer. I just want to thank the McDonough Group so much for joining us. Melissa, Ben, Emilio, Ray, Jordan. I thought this was really fun. It was really cool to get a panel together and to talk about a movie that's so fresh in our minds and so freshly adding to the sort of the cultural conversation, right? Like, it's exciting when a new movie comes out from filmmakers that we've been putting so much thought into their work. Yeah, it's a cool moment.
Yeah, and we just, you know, we love your guys' brains and we love your guys' perspectives so much. And it was just rad to, I feel like I had just walked out of the movie. We'd all basically just walked out of the movie. So I feel like I understand the film so much better. My appreciation for the film is so much deeper. And it was just really nice to see you guys and just to hang out again. So I really appreciate that.
Yeah, thank you for inviting us and getting me to the multiplex.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
Yeah, thank you guys. This was fun.
Everybody out there, see movies in theaters. And if you didn't see the movie and you listened to this all the way, I'm sorry.
I hope it was a great experience.
Yeah. And we'll be back real soon with another episode of To the White Sea.
We gotta get out of this place. If it's the last thing we ever do. We
To the White Sea is produced by Jordan Fish and Ray Tintori.
Starring Griffin Newman as Lieutenant Muldrow.
Production support provided by Ben Hosley and Ike Sreeskandaraja.
To the White Sea theme music written and performed by Dan Romer.
We gotta get out of this place. If it's the last thing we ever do. We gotta get out of this place. Girl, there's a better life for me and you. Believe me, baby. I know it, baby. You know it too.